the third thing, which is a fear of hope. That you might actually be a hopeful person, but you're afraid of this quality in your life. And that actually gets in the way of all the good that hope can do you. And as you'll see in our research, we find that people who actually score high on hope, but also score high on fearing hope, are often in the worst state, in worse state than somebody that's hopeless. They're agitated. They're struggling with this issue. And so it's not hopelessness that's getting in the way of them getting these resources, these things that make our lives better, but their fear of this thing that they actually have. And I'm using this presentation software called Prezi to talk to you. And I also, as you'll learn, I have attention issues. So I have to kind of keep this organized, even though this thing kind of goes all over the place. I'm going to walk you through sort of the steps we're going to take. So one is we're going to talk about the theory, and we're going to talk about how this applies in childhood. But I actually don't think that fear of hope is something we have to think of as a developmental thing that you're stuck with for life. If something happens to you in adulthood that makes you fear hope, you'll still have this phenomenal experience. And then from there, I'm going to open it up for some questions. And from there, I'm going to talk about kind of the book a little bit and where hope rests in what this guy, Kurt Lewin, called a force field, how we think about this. Then I'm going to talk about fear of hope in adulthood. And then I am going to talk about how to think about it in relationship to psychiatric patients, but we can kind of take that and kind of understand it in our own lives and in all kinds of situations. And then I'm going to talk about this phenomenon I call non-hope, which is really this place where you approach life with such certainty that you're not really leaving room for hope. So I'm going to stop just a little bit with, can you guys see my son asking about holotropic breathing? I don't know why I'm his holotropic breathing coach, but turns out I am. I'm going to walk you through a little bit of my story because I'm hoping that kind of begins the process of understanding this fear of hope. This is me when I was about 11 years old. I even had a beard back then. I was a really creative kid. I lived in a college town where half the town was college professors and the other half, it was a suburb for the aerospace industry out in Pasadena in Los Angeles. And I went to school on the college professor side of town in grade school. And this was my my teacher, Lenny Katz. It was a real kind of alternative hippie school. And I was really kind of a Lenny, by the way, ended up being a real estate lawyer in Albuquerque, I'm sad to say. But I was kind of a star at the school. I was a really creative kid. And it felt to me as if life was in my hands, like I could make something and whatever I made would kind of be introduced to the world. And this is a drawing. I made a drawing of a dragon. And Lenny said, let's make a giant inflatable of that dragon and have the college students and the hippies from the town come hang out in it for the day. There was a newspaper article about it. That's Lenny with his head out the nostril of the dragon. What power I felt at that point, what creative power, this sense that the world was sort of open for me. And I went from that school to this school, and this was a school for the kids of aerospace executives. And I was immediately diagnosed with a severe learning disability. And the plan was for me to go, at that point, they didn't mainstream kids, was for me to go to a different school for kids that had learning disabilities. And that just destroyed that sense that I had control over my life. That label really hurt me. And the fact that I couldn't quite function in the way this school was teaching. And so I really was afraid of kind of hoping again and trying again. And I invented an identity. And so I became what the kids called a stoner. And I really didn't smoke that much pot, but it was an identity I could live with because it was one that kept everybody's expectations low about me and kind of explained my position in life, that I wasn't going to try too hard. And along with that identity also came this identity as a disabled person. I would tell people all the time, the reason why I can't do that is I have this disability. And I'm sure now that the event of being labeled and told these things was a much more powerful force in my life than whatever this thing was called a learning disability. I call it, I wasn't able to factory learn. I don't really believe there was a disability. Years later, as a social worker in a program, I created a group where we talked about change, and I would ask these people who had been in and out of institutions for years, what gets in the way of your change? And rarely would they say, it's my diagnosis. They would say these things that were very similar to what I went through in junior high, which was this kind of, how do I keep expectations low because I'm afraid of another event where I'm disappointed and hurt? And this is an open group. People kept coming in, but the 10 reasons kept coming up, these 10 reasons not to change. And by the way, Linda, when you said that you liked that part of my title in my book, because it doesn't feel like a self-help book, my title of the book originally was Don't Go Changing, and HarperCollins wouldn't do it. But I really wanted a book that was about why we don't change. That's really, to me, much more interesting, actually, than how we do, because then we discover kind of the self-loving element in us not changing. Mm. And I worked a lot with these people that would go in and out of emergency rooms all the time, people that are labeled parasuicidal. And I began to learn something about a lot of them, which was that they would go in often at the points when their life was getting better. That going in the hospital gave them an immediate sense that people's expectations were going down, and they were. And they got this sense that they could kind of control in a way that felt safe to them, the sense of hope in others and maybe in themselves. So I wrote this book, and that turned into this book, which is for the general public in some ways. And the newest book with HarperCollins is about this book, Harold and the Purple Crayon, and it's really trying to talk about how to rethink lives that are drawn by us and creative. And it's really trying, I think, for me to get back to that self I was in grammar school, to get back to a pride in approaching life creatively, not a sense that there's something disabled about you in that. So speaking of children's book, that's one that really is dear to me. And then all of this led to this Fear of Hope scale, which we validated. This is an actual event in people's lives, this thing we call fear of hope. So what is fear of hope? Well, we know what it's not. And that's, you know, I'm not a big researcher, but I'm learning that that's a big deal when you're doing research. It's not fear of success. It's not fear of failure. It's not anxiety. It's not depression. And most importantly, it's not hopelessness, like I said. And here's what we've learned in the research. That actually when people score high as hopeful people, but they fear hope, all kinds of things happen. They have high counterfactuals. That means that they're constantly rethinking what they did last. Should I have done this? Should I have done that? What could have happened differently if this happened? They have a poor relationship with their emotions. They don't trust their emotions. They don't feel like they're effective in the world. They have less coping resources. They think in a shorter time perspective, which means if you ask them what happened before today and what happened in front of today, it's going to be a very short period of time, like they're sort of stuck in time. They're less likely to locate positive events in the future, less likely than someone who's hopeless. And they feel stuck. They feel completely stuck. Now, one of the interesting parts of the research, and I'll get to this later, is that this issue of a poor relationship with emotions, which I'll explain more later, and the counterfactuals, people have these thoughts about what I could have done differently after this event where they have a poor relationship with their emotions. So the fear of hope creates a poor relationship with emotions, and then they're constantly thinking, what could I have done differently? They're ruminating on this. And that'll become important later. So I see fear of hope as this kind of profound thing, you know. Obviously I do. I write about it. I think about it. But that it's as if the thing that draws us to life. Hope is the thing that draws you through uncertainty. That's what it is. It's a stance towards uncertainty where you keep going. This thing that pushes you through life is poisoned. You feel like it's dangerous. It may be the most dangerous thing in front of you. It's like being a high diver and afraid of heights. And when I think about fear of hope, I think about a person that's in this kind of a position.
I did.
Det här visar man inte. Man ska bara bestämma sig och göra det.
I think that hope is a central element in our connections. I think that we, as a society, in my profession especially, we make the mistake of seeing people as separate and sort of treated in their separateness. And instead, there is this negative space between us that's always shifting and changing and really should be the site of how we think about our own experiences. There's a world around us that's influencing how we change, how we hope, and it's all happening on some level in relationship and in connection. And that hope lives in that space. It lives in the space between us and a world that goes on independent of us and between us and other people. And it replaces in some ways something we need at the first moment when we connect, which is oxytocin, which is something that allows us to take the risk of connecting to a being that is 100 times larger than us, that can crush us. And for us to reach towards that being and connect, that's a very important hormone, but it's a very weak one. It doesn't last long. We need something else to get it, to get us to take the risk of engagement. And that's why I see hope as really a central element in what's happening in our first moments of connection, but in every connection. And why, when people talk today a lot about our attachments, I think they're missing something. That what we're struggling with in our attachments is not the event of connecting to another, but the struggle over disappointments that happened when we tried to invent and when we do. So it's about hope. This child is hoping every time he points. He's hoping for a connection, and he's taking the risk of the devastating experience that he can't get his needs met and he can't be connected. And so every time he's interacting with his parent, he's taking this risk all of us take every time we hope. Because can I risk this sense that I can't quite get fed? I can't quite meet my expectations. Very interesting that these two qualities of hope. So this is a Snyder scale. If you were to take a scale on whether you're hopeful or not, you'd probably be taking the scale. And it's really a scale on the results of hope. So two things happen for people that are hopeful. They look for alternative pathways, which means you see a barrier and then you're saying, well, how do I go around that? How do I get around that? And the other is they have some sense I can do it. That's called agency thinking. I'm able to do this. Those are the two elements of hopeful people. And that makes hope this powerfully important posture towards life that is about how do I make it through uncertainty? Hope isn't optimism. Optimism is this hope, is a certain event. Everything will be great. That's optimism. Hope is, will there still be a me? Will there still be an us after this event? And can we get through it? Can I keep walking and pushing in the face of uncertainty? A very important emotion, that one. The main thing that kind of defines us as different than the other animals has to do with this thing called the neocortex, this giant part of our brain. And it's built for us to do something really remarkable, which is to collaborate in order to invent things. And to collaborate in order to invent things, you have to be able to do two things. You have to be able to think about alternative pathways. How do we get around this thing to make a decision, to figure things out? And you have to have a sense that you're bringing something to the table. And those are the two elements of hope. So for me, hope is kind of central to who we are as human beings. It's kind of a central molecule for what gets us through life, but it also makes us most human because it's kind of the central molecule of collaboration. When you hope, you're hoping for something. You're heading towards something. And so hope is always an event where you make something more important than it was before you hoped for it. So a holiday's coming up and somebody asks you what you want and you don't know. And the minute you say bike, a bike becomes an important element in your life. And if you don't get that bike, you then recognize more that you don't have a bike in your life. So hope is always adding this risky element to life, which is it makes things important. And if you don't get the thing, you're faced with the fact that you lack it in your life. So with hope, you're always climbing up a hill of higher and higher experiences of making something important. And you're always taking the risk of falling from that hill. And the higher you hope, the more you fall. Now I said this alternative pathways idea, you know, you're kind of trying to figure things out and trying to get around them. But also in the middle of hope is this other thing that I've mentioned, which is agency thinking. I can do it, or even the world outside me is benevolent enough to allow me to do it. And there's another word for that that isn't quite hope, and that's faith. Faith is the belief in something, in yourself, in the world, and at the core of hope is the capacity to keep having faith, to keep kind of believing in some level of trust in yourself or in the world around you. Faith is very close to this concept of self-efficacy. I can make this work, or the world will allow me to make this work. And this is also related to something else I'll get to in a little bit, which is this thing called affect as information. When you act in a faithful way, you're depending on your emotions. You're saying, my gut tells me to do this. You're calculating things in your head, but you're relying on your emotions as this kind of authority in your life that can tell you whether it's the right decision or not. So when we hope, we appoint something as important. And when the thing doesn't happen, there's disappointment. There is this loss of this thing we've appointed as disappointment. And that loss is an event in which we learn something about the world that can be harmful to us, which is that we may not be able to get our needs met or be cared for in the way we want. So I don't know if you guys know this experiment, but the mother here has been asked to now do a flat face in response to her kid. And watch all the alternative pathways he picks. Tries laughing. Tries pointing. He tries reaching out, maybe touching her. And now he's starting to have these experiences of disappointment. So he tries clapping. Another experience of disappointment. Now he tries another person in the room. Now he's heading towards something worse than disappointment, a sense of despair. He tries his hardest to create something in this event. And he's learning that his actions aren't having any effect. When people come to my talk, they think it's going to be this nice, happy talk because we're talking about hope, but it's not, because the other side of hope is always this response and interaction with despair. And what we know about this event is that there's this kind of experience for the child of profound helplessness. I can't make my life work. And it's that kind of helplessness, I think, is affecting all of us when we have, even in adulthood, massive experiences of disappointment. And we know from the early research on connections that two things happen. Children get into what's called an anaclitic depression. They stop interacting with the world. They just stop connecting because they, in my mind, they don't want to try again. They don't want to make something important and have that experience of helplessness. They'd rather have an experience of numbness and disconnection than an experience that they can't make their world work, that their gestures mean nothing. Or they become what we call avoidantly attached. I'm going to turn away from the world. I'm not going to try to connect because I don't want to have that experience again of my attempt to be connected with the world failing and learning something sort of dangerous and difficult about myself, which is maybe I can't get my needs met. And I think that that event, not only in children, but in our own lives, has this profound experience on our willingness to hope. We see that And we see how it affects our emotions, the emotions of a person with fear of hope. They begin to distrust those emotions because those emotions are the ones that allowed them to kind of make the risk of hope. It was that gut feeling of faith. And now they're saying, I can't let those emotions affect me in that way. So emotions become fake news. I can't trust them. And that's why this happens. They fear hope. They stop trusting their emotions. And then they're constantly questioning themselves about what should I have done differently. One way to look, and I hope it's okay, Linza, that I say this, but you know, one way to look at Linza and her books is that she's on that diving board. She's doing counterfactuals beforehand. What would it be like? What'll this happen? What'll this happen? And in my mind, part of that is the struggle over if I make this gesture towards something different in my life, will I end up in this place where I sort of regret that and have to rethink it and sort of that sense of disappointment? And that's where kind of disappointment plays this kind of massive element in our lives. There's this syndrome in Sweden with Syrian refugee children where they come to Sweden and they actually do pretty well in school. They build friendships and they connect. And then their parents get rejected for asylum. And then when their parents go for an appeal, they go to sleep. It's called resignation syndrome. And they can sleep for a year. And they're asleep. You can put ice on them. You can talk to them in loud noises. It's not a coma. It's kind of being asleep. And the psychiatrists in Sweden talk about it as the best coping they possibly could come up with, to just take a break from having hope until the event is over, because they just can't stand the possibility of another disappointing event. So that kind of gets us through this idea about how fear of hope works, how it works in childhood, but also maybe if you could think about how it's generalized to adulthood. And I thought if we wanted to for a few minutes, I'll answer some questions, and then from there I'll go forward if anybody has any.
Can you move us off screen sharing so we can see raised hands?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, that'd be great.
How's that?
That's great. So do we have any questions for Ross? Yeah, Barbara.
So I got the impression you deal with people who in fact have addictions. When do drugs come in as a compensating factor for the sense of hopelessness? Is there a particular entry point?
Well, I mean, one thing that I feel pretty sure about regarding problematic habits is that they really come about when a person doesn't have an opportunity to feel connected to other people in a way that's meaningful, where they have a sense of purpose and connection in life. And so it does come out of an experience of hopelessness, but also probably an experience of sort of fearing, trying again and connecting and being a part of life. That what we call addiction, I have some issues with that term because I don't really know what it means. I know what a problematic habit is. I know we all have habits in our life that we can't quit. Is typically a person who's trying to kind of get to a sense of well-being that we should have in our connections to others. And part of that process is about hope. I do feel like the process of recovery from problematic habits is all about, in some ways, all about fear of hope. If I get sober for 2 days and I feel good about my sobriety, how horrible is it going to feel if I break my sobriety on day 3? Right. And then how's my family going to respond? You know, they're going to get excited and then I'm going to let them down again. And so the problematic habit becomes more attractive than changing, because it means no one's expectations are going up. And I think that that's sort of a central element in recovery. And it really is. It's sort of part of what AA does, too, is how do you kind of keep your hope going along the way?
And Barbara Sweet.
Yes, when the child reaches out and the mother doesn't respond, is the next step sometime sometimes something must be the matter with me. I've got to figure out what I'm doing wrong. And so the child spends the rest of his life trying to figure out what's wrong with him and how he can change so that eventually the mother will respond.
Yeah. Yeah. So in really catastrophic situations, in which you're not being nurtured, you have two choices. You can recognize the terror of the fact that you're not being protected, or you can have hope that something you do can change that, that something's wrong with you. And that as long as you can change that, you can change the situation. And the second alternative is just a safer psychological alternative. It's a horrible alternative, but you're not given the better alternative, the third alternative of being in a nurturing environment. And so the typical thing we all do, and I've done it in my own life, is say, well, there must be something about me because the other thing's just too terrifying to bear, that nobody's there to protect me. And so self-blame becomes this self-loving mechanism in a strange way. It's just something we have to kind of get rid of later on. But it's the only way to kind of get out of that situation without completely disintegrating. Does that make sense to you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'd like to ask a question and tag on to that too, to say, I've noticed that sometimes that self-blame gets inverted into other blame, so that there's a habit of blaming others too that can happen. But my question from your book is, I was fascinated by this idea that those people who had fear of hope accompanied by high hopes were the ones that had the hardest time. So I would love to hear from you about how do our hopes get too high, and how do we think our way through that? I mean, it seemed to me that you were saying some connection to your emotions would teach you that, but I'd like to just hear more about how people get their hopes too high.
I don't know if there's such a thing as hopes too high. I think that there's the challenge of having the courage to hope.
Yeah.
In the face of fear of hope.
Yeah.
And I'll get to that at the end more. We really can't fix our hope. But we can fix our faith. We can work on, I'm able to do the best job at running my life, and I can be competent at a life, and I can make my life work, and I can get together with people and actually have an experience that we've affected the world or our community. Mm-hmm. And those are all faith building events. And the more you have faith in yourself and in others, the more you're willing to take the risk of hope, because hope is risky. It doesn't ever, the risk never goes away. It's a risky event. So it's really about, do I have enough faith in myself that if the disappointment happens, I'm going to be okay at the end? And that we can work on. We work on it through getting good at things, through therapy, through whatever it is, that kind of sense that I'm an okay person, I can get through this.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Any other questions or examples or comments for Ross?
Okay, I'll get back to it if I can find it. Is it up there?
It's black so far, but it says you have started screen sharing, but it only is showing as black.
Let me try this one more time. I'm sorry, folks. I don't know what's happened.
Yeah, me neither. Marianne, do you have a clue?
I don't. I see what you see, but...
It is going into screen.
It's going, yeah. There you go.
There you go.
Yeah, I'm going to have to start this. Oh, there we go. Perfect. Excellent. So there's this guy. He basically invented, he's one of the inventors of social psychology named Kurt Lewin. He's very important in kind of our thinking about how the world affects us in a psychological way. he's also kind of the founder of organizational psychology. And he had this very simple story to tell, which is that change really exists like this. It's really as if that ball and the where it sits is where you are in relationship to the thing that you want to change in your life.
So we're not seeing a one individual picture. We're just sort of seeing your menu.
Oh, geez, really? Well, if I don't make this work, we're just going to talk.
It's okay.
Whatever works.
Let me try this one more time. I love this. I love doing this thing because it's fun, but you don't see
anything.
There
you go.
Now we see the ball. There it is. Yep. Okay.
There's the ball.
Yep.
And so we're really always in this place between things that are holding us back and things that are driving us forward. And those things are somewhat mysterious. We don't always know everything that's holding us back and pushing us forward. And even in Lindsay's story, you know, that moment where she started to kind of recover from the eating events, she heard that information at that meeting. But there might have been a million other things going around her that were also pushing her forward that she didn't even see. And I don't know about all of you, but in my life, there really isn't a moment where I all of a sudden change. Well, there is moments. I don't even know how it changed. It's like I'm planning this thing. I'm trying to do it. And then all of a sudden, something shifts and I'm able to do it. And I can't name that thing. I'll give you an example. I was on the way to a meeting at work in New York. It was a muggy day. I was really irritated and I had to give a manager at my work some feedback, and I'm really horrible at giving feedback. I hate doing it. I'm a person that really likes to be liked and it drives me crazy. And I really didn't think I was going to be able to do it. And I got on this elevator and it was a stuffed elevator, and a person on the elevator dropped their coffee. And another person on the elevator said, you know what, here's a packet of sugar. Why don't we pour it on it and see if that kind of absorbs it so there's not so much coffee in the thing. Another person came up with this other idea. And we got to like the third floor, and a person got off the computer and got off the elevator, and they yelled back, that was the best elevator ride ever. And we kept going. We kept working on this coffee spill, and we got to the 11th floor, and another person got off, and they yelled back, same time next year, same hour, let's all meet here. And everybody just started laughing. And I got off of that elevator and I was able at that point to give this person feedback. Now that might sound strange, but something in me lifted enough to push me over to that side, some sense of faith in humanity, faith in myself. It just took that. And so there's all these points in our lives where there's this interaction between the things that are kind of holding us down. For me, it was the muggy day. It was my lack of self-confidence, my irritation, and then little things, too, that kind of move us forward. But within that, and I'm going to try to present again because I'm not in presenter mode, so let's see if this works. Do you still see it?
Yes.
Okay. Within that, there's always this struggle between two specific things. There's all kinds of general things in our own lives, but two specific things. And one is this feeling like you're afraid of your own ability to make life work. And you're afraid of that bit. And then this capacity to hope. Because in life, we're really our own mirror. We're the person on the other side in some ways. And we have to deal with whether that person, not the parent, is capable of driving the bus that is our life, is capable of making our lives work. And that can be terrifying. That's what the existentialists call this aloneness and accountability. And so that's always there when we move forward. There's always this anxiety about, can I actually make my life work? And there's always this hope that maybe I can. So while there's specific things, there's always these two general things. And once you've had a lot of disappointments, you're feeling like, I can't trust the part of me that can get through life. This book just really blows me away how remarkably accurate it is in a lot of ways. Created by an artist who used to write for the New Front. It has all kinds of elements about dehumanization and kind of Marxist philosophy in it, I believe. But Here's this guy, he's drawing, he draws a dragon, he forgets that he drew the dragon, it becomes something sort of separate from him, his hand starts to shake, his anxiety creates a sea of anxiety, he sinks in it, but he's capable of drawing himself out. And that's what we need as we go through life is, can I go through this? And if the thing that happens is bad, can I still get myself out? Can I draw myself out? Can I find the creative alternative pathways to get myself out? So you have this existential anxiety, you have where you are, you have this hope, but once you've had these experiences of helplessness, it just gets squashed. You're just terrified. Am I capable of driving the bus? Can I make my life work? And in my field, we work with a lot of people who don't seem to have a really great relationship to what's going on for them, who kind of resist help. And one way to think of them for yourselves is a metaphor for everybody, which is that they don't quite want to metabolize care. They don't want to metabolize the help of others, and they lack some motivation. And remarkably, those two things are what's driving their lives, very much like that child with anaclectic depression and that child with the attachment, with avoidant attachment, what I call a perturbed relationship with help. I can't accept help. Help is the thing that could drive me towards another disappointment. There's another event where I feel the sense that I can't control my life. And so they're in that state. And in the same time, they're having all kinds of social experiences that make it hard for them to move forward. And I'll go through these quickly because it's a little less important for the conversation. They lost the social support. Social support gives you the ability to face threats and challenges in social psychology, and they have less of it. Loneliness. We know all about loneliness now. There's so much conversations about this, but, you know, it ties with cholesterol and smoking for heart disease because of all the cortisol being sent through your system. It makes you paranoid. It makes you isolate yourself. Ostracism. We've shown that ostracism affects the same part of the brain that affects pain. And purposelessness, which drives us towards being effective in our lives. All the psychological research says these are resources. And this all becomes missing for somebody who's been defined as having a psychiatric disability. Each one of these things gets ripped from them. And so the finger pushing down becomes stronger and more powerful. So they've got this going on, and then they have this thing that I call the 10 reasons not to change. And for me, this happens in all our lives. If I decide to change, I'm going to be raising my own expectations. And if I raise my own expectations, I'm raising the risk that I'll have that experience of helplessness again. If I don't change, I don't have to risk that experience of helplessness. I can play possum. If I change, the people around me will get excited about that change. And then they'll feel disappointed and I'll be seen as helpless in their eyes. If I change, I have to kind of face where I am in relationship to life. I'm sort of behind everybody else maybe, or I don't like where I am in life, but I have to kind of look at that. And that makes me feel helpless too. I'll have to take these small steps, and each small step just reminds me how far I am to the end. And so again, if I feel really helpless, if I feel like, you know, I'm going to be disappointed anyways at the end, I don't want to take those small steps. People are going to start seeing me as accountable. They're going to say things like, you know, well, if you can do this, you can do that. You can take better charge of your life. And that's terrifying. When my son used to call me from college and tell me he got an A on a paper, I was like a smoker who couldn't stop smoking because I knew what not to say. And I'd say it every time, which is, how are you doing in your other classes? Right? His success became this next event of accountability for me. But he's now contacting me about holotropic breathwork, so I guess I did okay. He's facing the unknown. I have to face this uncertainty of all the potential failures in front of me, all the things that could happen to me in my own life that will make me feel helpless. I have to face the fact that in some part of my life, I'm driving the bus. Not all of it, but there are parts where I have some control. I will lose the sense that people are kind of supporting me in a way that leaves me out on my own in a kind of dangerous and scary way. I'll lose a kind of attention. The better you do in life, the less people actually pay attention than if they're worried about you. And one person called number 10, destroying the negatives, that it's like in those old spy films where the negatives get destroyed, so there's no proof that something happened. If I do better, the bad things that happen to me, people are not going to notice them as much. They aren't. If I function, my functioning means the thing didn't destroy me, and that means I'm losing kind of a testament to the injuries I've had. So those are the 10 reasons not to change. And I think that those 10 reasons make a lot of sense. Now remember, we're sort of showing that hope and fear of hope can go together. And actually, when they go together, they create this really difficult situation. I think that when a person's not changing, they're protecting something. They're protecting something very important to them. They're protecting something from disappointment. What they're protecting is hope. They're actually trying to preserve their hope because they don't want another assault on it, another chipping away at their hope. And so not changing is this event of kind of self-love. It's an event of an attempt to kind of preserve yourself, to protect yourself. Someday I'll act again, but right now I have to kind of protect this feeling inside of me. In my field, if I'm right, we take this preservation and we have names for it. We call it being non-compliant, treatment resistant. They're in denial. They're treatment refractory. We have this crazy word called anastenosia, which comes from stroke victims. And we don't even know if it exists in mental health, but we use it all the time. They can't see their disability. They can't see it. Difficult to engage. We just come up with all of these insults for an event that really is a person trying to take care of themselves. These are the negative symptoms of schizophrenia. They're about a person who stops interacting with the world, who loses motivation, and can't sort of stick to activities. And psychiatry has decided, and this decides a person's fate as far as their livelihood more than hearing voices, these negative symptoms, and you can't treat it with medication. And somebody's decided that that's diagnosable when it looks to me like despair. It looks to me like maybe someone fearing hope. They never located where this mechanism is that creates these negative symptoms, but they've decided it comes part and parcel with the disease. So these events in people's lives that are really about the spiritual kind of struggle over hope get defined in this kind of way that's calling it a disease. And even the best of us in trying to help people, if we don't recognize that maybe what they're struggling with is with hope, we end up making really the mistake of this guy's friend.
Thank you for
My book is really meant as a criticism of any approach that thinks change is easy, or that if you do certain things, you'll change. And so, psychotherapy is guilty of that. Psychiatry is guilty of that. The self-help movement is really guilty of it. 5 easy steps. As if we take those 5 easy steps and everything just changes. Instead of it's this really existential moment every time we change. It's a very powerful moment in our lives. And that the 5 easy steps are so easy as long as you're at a place in that Lewinian force field where you're ready to change. But you know what? If you're ready to change, you don't need those 5 easy steps. You're ready. You just do it. And so change is really about contemplating and being in that place where you're ready and then doing it. And that's a difficult thing. So like I said before, you really can't work on hope. It's just there. And it's always threatening. It's never not threatening. It's never not scary. But you can work on faith. And by the way, that's the pit in the peach before, because someone last week pointed out it looks like a nut and that would be horrible. But it's the faith, the center of hope you can work on. You can build in people, and we can build it in ourselves. It takes a couple things to do it. And this isn't about therapy. It's about every bit of change, but it's the research on therapy. Remarkably, in our field right now, I don't know if you guys hear about this all the time. There's best practices. Everybody's doing the best practice. By the way, the research on these is really kind of poor. And what we've discovered actually is that there is one thing that's happening in all those best practices that is the same. That's actually the thing that's making each one of them work. One thing. And it's the event of having a collaborative relationship with somebody else. Somebody who's saying, where do you want to head in that force field, and how can I help you figure out how to get there? Which in some ways is the opposite of saying, you know what we're going to work on is your abstinence, or we're going to work on is your symptom. It's like, where do you want to be in life? And then how does this thing in the force field maybe get in the way of it or not? Having somebody by your side walking you through that is what helps with change, because change comes about when you're able to safely weigh the pros and cons of your situation. And that includes whether you want to change or not. And that happens in a collaborative relationship. But something else, 40% of change happens outside of any treatment or any collaborative relationship. It has to do with your environment, where you live, what's happening for you. And so for me, the really important event that needs to happen in all our lives, but especially for my clients, is that there's an experience of someone next to you, and you're doing whatever small things in your life help you build faith. So if you want to get rid of all your books, maybe you get rid of something other than books first, or you get rid of a few books, whatever it is that kind of rebuilds your faith in yourself. In my field, there's all this talk now about skill building, and I just don't buy it. I don't think a single one of my clients lacks the skill to fill out a checkbook or clean their apartment. They lack faith in their ability to do those things. So every time you're able to help yourself or help another person meet even a small challenge, you're therapeutically working on your faith. It really is very close to the Saul Alinsky model of community organizing, which is, get a stop sign on the corner first, and that builds faith in the community that you can make things happen. Small events really are the things that kind of slowly build that faith up. So that's kind of the story of hope and fear of hope. I have 3 more minutes.
Yes.
I want to briefly talk about something else, which is what I call non-hope. And non-hope isn't hopelessness. It's when you X out hopelessness or hope by being certain of things. Hope only occurs in relationship to uncertainty. If you're certain, there's no such thing as hope. And in my field, but in our public in general, in the public discourse in general, there's a significant amount of certainty going on about people's behavior, about who's sick and who's not, who's normal and who's abnormal, what is a disease, what is not. And it's all kind of mythology. Nobody I don't even know what these diseases mean, including the disease, by the way, of addiction. I don't know what they mean by disease. I don't know where the disease happened. But there's this medical story going on that's very certain. And that's a non-hope story. In the face of that story, you can't think of alternative pathways, and there's no you in that story that's moving along. And it's really taking a model of thinking about things, what Gregory Bateson called non-living things, and applying it to the world of the living, which is a world that is completely improvisational. All growth, all recovery, all health is an improvisational moment that you cannot be certain about. And what Gregory Bateson said is when you apply a world of certainty to a world of uncertainty, there's a name for that, and that's violence. You're treating a living event as if it's non-living, like treating a rabbit like it's a rock. And in my field, we're doing this constantly. We're constantly churning out these diagnoses and these stories about people and these prognoses that really turn them in towards these things that you can't hope for because they're things. And we're treating them kind of this living thing as if it's non-living. And I won't do this video for you because we're done, but I do want to show you one last thing.
Thank you, Ross. We appreciate so much all that you've brought to us. So now is our time for open discussion, and not only to what's been said here today, but also to what's stirring inside of each of you. Each of you is challenged by change in some way or another. We've talked about it here as a group. We talked about some in reflections. And so how are the things that you've heard today, how have they stirred in your heart, in your mind, in your wondering how it fits your circumstance? And if you want to share that about yourself, a change that you're challenged by, please do that as well. We promise no one will jump in and try to help you. So, okay, Linda, you need to unmute.
Yes. I had hoped, I was looking forward to an uplifting experience today. And no offense, but it wasn't so uplifting. I saw more of the negative, the petrification. You know, I think loss of social support, loneliness, ostracism, purposelessness. Oh, my goodness. This is, these are the things that characterize my current life. So I got such a thrill about the woman who just faked it till she made it, jump right off of the diving board, and I feel like I'm in some ways that person. But what I wanted to say was one of the things I noticed both about your, Linda, your talk and Ross's is the power of reflection and contemplation that I thought his book really offered a framework in which for me to just reflect on my own life and what I want to be and to kind of like gather up the faith and the hope that I can work toward that, you know, despite my loss of social support, loneliness, ostracism, and purposelessness. So I guess that was my, you know, I really appreciate your reflection on your eating disorder, because I think, you know, it was a long time, and that was, you know, really a tough thing. But I think, you know, it was your reflection. It seemed to me anyway, that it was your reflection on that that helped you to realize a different path forward, or a different way to look at your situation and change it.
Yeah, that's true. And in the diving board, the last video, I had a different sense of it than you did, Linda. I didn't think she was faking it. I thought she was almost trying to find the pipeline to her faith, the pipeline to whatever messages. We probably all had different impressions of what just happened, but some pipeline to her own faith and trust in herself. And then
I don't think that's different than what my impression of it, because I think that's what faking it till you make it is, that somewhere you do believe you have it in you, but you know, you just kind of have to take that leap of faith. You have to step out into the unknown and try. And that's hard. I have a friend, this book so resonated with me. My friend has had some bad emotional journey, you know, some disappointments in her dating life. And she's, you know, I see her wanting to get back out there and date, but kind of not taking that risk and not doing it. And me being that guy on the springboard saying, come on, you can do it. Or, and then realizing that maybe she's just too emotionally fragile right now. Maybe she can't do it. Maybe she's in that wait and see mode. And just then trying to be there for her and trying to, you know, talk through or help be that, just that support person, just the person in the room she can throw, you know, things around with. Okay. Well, let other people talk and get in on the conversation, but those were my thoughts on this.
Okay. Can I respond for
always? Yeah.
You know, there's so many forces keeping her from moving forward. Your friend, that she may not recognize how powerfully she is. And that's a different conversation than saying something's wrong with you, you're not changing. It's saying, you know, you might be a really courageous person. It's just pushing up against all these forces,
mm-hmm.
You know? And to me, that's a better conversation in some ways than a deficit conversation,
mm-hmm.
Right? And I believe that anyways. I just believe it. I just believe it, mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm.
That's good.
Yeah. And for me, that image of the last one is really about courage. I mean, she has courage. She just has courage. She's just like, I'm going to do this, you know? And to me, it's a beautiful sight to see her try to just do it, you know? Yeah. Well, one other thing came to mind when you were talking, which is that Lewin said something very interesting. He had this idea of time perspective, which is that if you know where the thing is that you're heading towards and you have some sense of the time it'll get you to get there, there's more hope in that. And what COVID's done is it's just completely collapsed. And COVID and the growing authoritarian state, these two things that we don't know when it's going to happen, and climate change, all these things, they've destroyed our time perspective. You have no sense of where the thing's going to be. So remember COVID, everybody said that they were going to finally learn to play guitar and then nobody did? It's because like, you had no tension. There was no tension between now and the point when you're good at guitar. There was no sense of, and once the tension is relaxed, because there's no time perspective, there's no motivation. Mm-hmm. And that really is kind of a central element of all this, if that makes sense. You know?
That's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, Ross, you don't know what the other people know about me is I have moved with my partner to Tennessee from the Northeast and, you know, during COVID, completely isolated, and, you know, left my job where I was, you know, had an executive position and now I'm not working. And I too had the dream of writing a book, haven't written a word, you know.
Yeah. So the one way to think about that again is those forces. Oh my God, look at all these forces that are holding me back. And what a remarkable job I'm doing considering all those forces, you know. That, to me, that's a better way to approach that situation, right? And And so I'm trying to tell you that I hope that this talk was a little more positive than you think, because it really is about, like, we're all courageously pushing against a lot of things in different points in our lives, you know?
Yeah. Mary Rose, you had your hand up. You're muted.
I just want to make sure I understand. At the very end, when you were talking about non-hope and hope, I was thinking, because I'm a nurse, I was thinking, like, someone gets a cancer diagnosis. Is the non-hope person saying, I'm just going to die, that's all there is to it? And is the hopeful person saying, I'm going to try every possible holistic approach or anything I can to continue living and not accept that diagnosis?
I was more talking about your attitude towards somebody you're trying to help.
Okay.
And so if a doctor says, here are the 5 things you can do to fix your cancer,
mm-hmm.
and anything else you do is flaky, that's non-hope. It doesn't mean that the doctor is not hopeful. It means the doctor has imposed this sense of certainty on the situation that's really bullshit, because we don't know how people recover.
Exactly.
That's what I mean. And then that generates hopelessness in the person hearing it. It's like, well,
right.
That's what I meant. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
And psychiatry is more complicit in this in some ways than the other medical professions, because it's saying you're a this, not you have cancer. You're a this. And this is how this happens now from now on in. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Any other? I think Marcia.
Hi. I work with Alzheimer's patients and dementia patients. And lately I've had more like beginning dementia patients. And one of the ladies, she always repeats, and she keeps saying, I have dementia, I have dementia, I have dementia, over and over and over. And her family, you know, fed that to her and yelled it at her and so forth and so on. And so I've been coming to this consciousness that the labels are so destructive. So I've been trying to reword for her, just saying, well, you have some memory issues or short-term memory issues, but you can remember your childhood and you can remember when you got married and when the kids were little, and to like really pump her up to some sort of positive thinking. This is one person in particular that I'm thinking of. But I'm so glad that you're speaking out, Ross, about the diagnoses. Because I've just seen so many people, not only with Alzheimer's and dementia, but schizophrenia and so forth. So I think you need a big bullhorn to keep yelling that out in the middle of Harvard Square or Times Square or whatever. Let's move beyond the diagnoses and really treat the whole person, the whole human being.
To me, it's the diagnoses, and then it's the apparatus around those, which is we treat health as health and mental health as if it's a factory. And so you get sent somewhere, and then certain tools fit your certain illness. And if those tools don't work, then something's really seriously wrong with you. And that factory orientation is so injurious to a person's identity and sense of themselves, you know? So it begins with the diagnosis, but it's actually the treatment itself, the way in which we process people as if they're broken lawnmowers. We're fixing, you know?
And thank you. Thank you so much for your work around this.
Yeah.
I'm cheering for you.
And I think we have these two alternatives. We have 3 alternatives, you know. One is dementia. The other is, don't even use that word. And the other is what you're doing, which is, how can I help you build a relationship to this event that's happening to you? I'm not claiming it's not happening. Let's give it, and this comes from narrative therapy. Let's give it a different name. What would you like to call it? And then what's your relationship with that? How does it affect your life? Is there somewhere where the dementia actually it's helpful. There's some ways where it's not. When you were a kid, did you forget things? This is a kind of forgetting. You know, let's have a conversation about that. And that's a different world than there's no such thing in or that's too much. That's you are in relationship, you're contemplating, and we're trying to get the person to a place of contemplation.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. Those are good hints. Good ideas.
Yeah. Yeah. I have all kinds of great ideas, and I just don't put them into practice when I'm meeting with people. It's a whole other story when we're actually dealing with a complex human person in front of us.
My other big beef is people who are taking 13 pills, mm-hmm. and the pills end up giving them dementia, or mm-hmm. hallucinations, or dizziness, and so forth and so on. And mm-hmm. I've got a client, you know, who's on the 13 pills, and she's going into huge hallucinations, and she's yelling at her husband because he didn't see the dog under the table with a muzzle on, yeah. and the dog couldn't eat. Because the dog had a muzzle on, you know.
Yeah.
But I want to just say, I also hear you inviting us to remember the role of contemplation when we are considering change.
Mm-hmm.
Leave room for that
mm-hmm.
in terms of bringing it to our community as a whole
mm-hmm.
or to our relationship with others who want to change. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, I also thought that it was wonderful to feel like staying the same isn't necessarily a bad thing, that sometimes you need to stay the same. I love the image in your book of recharging your battery. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes you just need to recharge. Sometimes that you contemplate whether or not staying the same is the state you should be in right now. And you kind of giving yourself that, I don't know, that latitude, that being kind to yourself mm-hmm. with where you are in the process. I think I need to learn more of that.
You know, I don't say this enough in the book or at all, but staying the same is sometimes a revolt against a world that's constantly telling you that something's wrong with you. And your job is to keep fixing yourself. You know, and so how many changes are we doing in our lives where it's really about social messages, not about something that's going to make our life more fulfilling? It's like, well, this is how it's supposed to be, and I'll finally get to normal if I do this, or you know. And so some of it's staying the same. It's like, no, I'm not going to follow that narrative, you know.
So anyone else who hasn't shared yet, is there something you want to ask or let us know that you're thinking about right now? In your own lives? Yes, Sandra, you're muted.
Yeah, okay. Is that unmuted now?
You're good, yep.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know if this is really relevant. It sort of came to me, so I will share it. Was part of the talk reminded me of a time when I suddenly knew. It felt like it wasn't a gradual experience of knowing that I could make this change. And I've been trying to figure out, I don't really know how to figure it out. All I know is it happened very quickly. That is its end result that I remember my husband had, we were not having, our marriage wasn't in good shape. I had the three kids and I was contemplating going back to school and stuff like that. And you know, I've been sort of wrestling around with these, how I would maybe be able to do it and all that. And I remember exactly where I was standing. I remember I was looking out a window and he was away at a conference. And I remember all of a sudden it just came to me. You're going to be fine. You're going to be all right. You mm-hmm. can. It was just the enormous sense mm-hmm. of it would be well. I really don't know. And I don't know, there must have been lead ups and so on. The only thing I can remember is that even from childhood, I have a memory of being like, 10 or 11 and believing that I could fly. Right. Mm-hmm. Well, and I practiced going up. There was this old chicken house in the backyard of this house that my parents had bought. And I would climb up on a garbage can and go up to the top and I would jump off and I would flap my arms believing that I could fly and failing each time and then going around and getting on the garbage cans and so on. And you could say I was, it was an exercise in futility. And yet I think back to that as the sense of a time in which I had this, you know, faith that I could do it, even when I, all the information told me, no, you're not gonna. But, you know, and of course through my life, I've had other kinds of experiences, which gave me the sense of, you know, being able to carry through some things, but that I just remember what really came to me, seeing the woman on the, you know, the diving board and that thing, that really just reminded me of that moment in which it felt like it was out of nowhere, looking out that window and having that sense. And this was, of course, as an adult, you know, that you'll be, it will, you know, in other words, whatever happens, it will be okay. It's hard to describe it. There's a statement, and I can't quote it to you, but I used to have it on a bulletin board about, hope is a thing. Something had to do with that no matter how it comes out, it's going to be, I wish I could find it. Maybe I can, you know, put in a post later, but it was a statement that somehow or other it will turn out well, even no matter how it turns out. It doesn't make sense, but.
That's no, just, it does. I'm going to take a quick second to, yeah. I probably won't find it.
You know the one I mean?
No, I'm looking for a different one by Pavel about. Vaclav Havel just says exactly what you're
yes,
saying.
Yes, it is Havel. Okay. Yeah, yeah, that's the very one. I was trying to remember the name of it.
And yeah, he's describing exactly what you're saying. And so what you're describing is hope. It's not everything's going to work out. It's that I'll still be here standing at the end.
No matter how.
I'll still have integrity. So hope is really connected to dignity too, which is I'll be here at the end.
Yeah.
That's just what you described is such a perfect portrait. Of what hope is. Yeah.
Yeah, and faith combined.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.